Welcome to The Point. I'm Indy Todd. Later in the hour, we talk poetry with members of our Poetry Sunday Advisory Board. We'll talk about some of the elements that make a good poem, how an editor can help refine a piece, and answer some of your questions about writing, editing, and submitting poems. But first, we talk with Will Dowd. He's just released a volume of essays titled Areas of Fog. Will Dowd, welcome. Good to
see you. Thank you so much for having me.
So your volume of essays uses New England weather as a starting point, and the book is arranged chronologically from January through December. Let's start with maybe you reading the overture to the collection.
Sure, I'd be happy to. Okay, so this is called Overture. All the weathermen of New England go mad eventually. After a few decades spent attempting to predict the unpredictable, they succumb to a kind of meteorological nihilism and wander out of the studio mid-broadcast, muttering to themselves, and can be seen a week later selling wilted roses on the side of the highway. It's not the seasonal anarchy, all those balmy Christmases and washed-out Junes, but rather the perverse changeability of our daily weather, the adolescent moodiness of our sun and sky, that finally unravels the sweater of their sanity. In the spring, I have counted 136 different kinds of weather inside of 4-20 hours, Mark Twain, a Hartford resident for 17 years, once quipped. Yet while they may be doomed to fail, we don't mock our weathermen. Even though we see them for what they are, oracles draped in sheep entrails, we don't change the channel. We listen politely to their forecast. And then we talk about it. In New England, the weather is all we talk about, especially when we have nothing to talk about. Lately, I've been suffering from writer's block. It's a serious disease. It struck Twain in the midst of composing The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn. After scratching 400 handwritten pages over the course of a single summer, the author suddenly found he could not write another word. For years, Huck and Jim were left stranded on the river, paddling in place. Eventually, Twain found his cure, a refreshing 16-month trip through Europe. I'm hoping to find my cure closer to home. Over the next year, I plan to keep a weather journal, a kind of running retrospective forecast. It will be accurate for one thing. I can say it rained today with 100% certainty, for example, because I swallowed some of it. But I have another reason for glancing at the near meteorological past. Writers only ever use the atmosphere for atmosphere. They never give the weather its literary due. Of course, weather is necessary to a narrative of human experience, Twain wrote, but it ought to be put where it will not be in the way, where it will not interrupt the flow of the narrative. So here's a place just for the weather. A snow globe without a figurine or a monument, just the weather. And maybe, probably, my reflection in the glass.
All right, so talk about your experience with writer's block.
Oh, it was dreadful. I know there's writers who claim it doesn't truly exist, but I'm a survivor, so I can tell you it is real. I just lost, what I felt like I really lost was a sense of my reader. You sort of look at the blank page and you don't quite know what you're supposed to write because you don't know who you're addressing and who you are. And so it just becomes a really ambiguous, ambivalent, crazy process trying to write. And so what I did by introducing the weather is I kind of changed the dynamic because we talk about the weather with strangers at bus stops and in waiting rooms. And it's just a way to open up a conversation. And so for me, that's what the weather is in this book. Every essay opens with a quick sort of what happened this week in the weather. And then that just breaks the ice.
Mm. So what compelled you to use the weather as a starting point for your essays rather than something? I mean, you've used similar devices in the past. I mean, yeah, weather is something we talk about, but there are children, there are, you know, the beach. There's lots of things that you can start conversations with.
Yes. So I think what's special about the weather, so there's a cynical way to look at our kind of, you know, it's always this annoying regional habit we have as New Englanders, always harping on about the weather, and it's just neutral filler. But actually, I think the reason why we continually talk about it and why it has some value is because it's a unifier. Everybody, no matter how old they are, how rich or poor they are, if there's slush on the street, your socks are getting wet. Doesn't matter who you are. And so there was a real sense that it was common ground.
Mm.
And that, and again, feeling alienated from the reader, or like, you know, as a writer, am I supposed to talk from some mountaintop? Just putting myself on the same level really helped.
Yeah. The book starts with January. And was it January when you started writing The Journey?
I started in January. I started January 1st.
All right. Yeah. So would you read one of the essays from the month of January, the one titled Bare Bones?
Yes, I'd be happy to. Bare Bones. It's always this time of year when the snowstorms have begun to bleed into each other and the air just teething in December now has real bite that my pale Irish skin loses its ivory sheen and becomes actually translucent. And you can see my major organs quivering like koi fish under a layer of ice. It was a week of slow, steady accumulation. On Saturday, we had snowflakes the size of movie tickets. On Wednesday, they flew in our eyes like flicked ash. By Friday, every window in New England was like the frame of an Andrew Wyeth winter landscape. Andrew Wyeth loved this time of year. The painter, who died 5 years ago this week, spent most of his life on long walks, with his paper and sable brushes, trying to find the right snowbank to sit on. God, I've frozen my ass off painting snow scenes, he once supposedly said. It's one thing to be a plein air artist in the south of France, but anyone who shoveled their driveway this week has to respect a man who painted mittenless in this weather for decades. For Wyeth, exposure to the elements was essential to his art. It got him out of his head. When I'm alone in the woods across these fields, I forget all about myself, he said. I don't exist. I'd just as soon walk around with no clothes on. I used to think Wyeth chose his favorite subject, isolated barn in a sea of snow, mostly to save paint. Some of his finished watercolors are more than 70% untouched paper. But the more I look at his wintry landscapes, the more they seem to take on an otherworldly glow. For Wyeth, the white space of winter was not a shortcut. It was a mystery. I prefer winter and fall when you can feel the bone structure in the landscape, the loneliness of it, the painter said. Something waits beneath it. The whole story doesn't show. This is especially true for Snowbirds, a Wyeth watercolor that was recently slated to be auctioned at Christie's for $500,000. Shortly before being sold, it was discovered to be a fake. You can always expect a flurry of forgeries in the wake of an artist's death. There are small details that give it away. For example, Wyeth painted pine trees by laying down an undercoat of green, then trickling black branches over it, not the reverse as seen in the fraud. Also, the forger was too stiff in his brushwork. The shadows are labored, the hillside is stilted, even the signature is too neat. Wyeth, who painted with fingers that ached to be back in his warm pockets, was all speed and dash with his brushes. No, this winter landscape was not painted by Andrew Wyeth. It was not painted by someone whose hands were cold.
So your essays have somewhat of a stream of consciousness feel. And you mentioned the weather begins the musings, and it goes on to many other things. So talk a little bit about the impact of weather on the psyche and how that sets this other thought of motion, you know, brings you down these other trails.
Yeah, it's funny. It's actually a great segue because Andrew Wyeth is my favorite artist, and he found all his inspiration by taking long walks. And he reminds me when he describes his process of somebody walking with a dowsing rod, you know, looking for water under the ground, because he would sort of wander around and then be struck by a particular a piece of landscape or a profile of a neighbor, and he would sort of feel the hair on the back of his neck stand up, and he couldn't quite put his finger on what it was, but there was some kind of emotion or something that was making him sensitive to that particular image, and he would paint to kind of figure that out and evoke that. And so I think so much of what being a writer or a poet is about is being a little bit like a weather vane and being sensitive to the elements. And so what I would do when I would write these essays is sort of experience, sort of lick my finger and put it up to the wind and just sort of let the weather take me wherever it wanted to go. And I happen to have a very associative way of thinking. It's part of the reason I kept the essay short, because I feel like I could keep going and going and going. that's just sort of how my brain works. So, yeah.
So You're in this snowstorm this winter. So what connects you to Andrew Wyeth? He's your favorite artist. So are you thinking, as you're out there experiencing the snow and the wind, are you thinking, wow, Andrew Wyeth was out here painting in this? Is that what brought you to that connection?
It's complete improvisation. And so, yeah, so I would, when I started that essay, Bare Bones, I'm talking about, okay, well, now we're really in winter. You know, December was just practice. And I look out my window and that, wow, okay, that reminds me of Andrew Wyeth. So I have no idea when I start where I'm going to end up.
Oh, fun.
So, you know, Frost said famously, no surprise for the writer, no surprise for the reader.
That's a great one. Yeah, great quote. So what's your normal writing routine? Do you try to write every day, or how does it work?
You know what I do? I daydream every day, and I concoct wild and crazy writing projects that may or may never come to fruition. But this, which is my first published work, was one of those crazy ideas. So I'm building castles in the air every day. At least one castle exists. I don't write necessarily every day, but when I do write, it's kind of feverish. Mm-hmm. So. I'm like a sprinter versus a marathon writer.
So, you got to get it out there.
Oh, yeah. I'm an adrenaline writer. So I would do these every Sunday morning. I would sit down and do them in one sitting, because that was kind of my that's just my pattern. I would I could think about it all. If I tried to write it all week, I would end up with the same product of quality and length as if I sat down in an adrenalized spiky moment on a Sunday morning and did it in 45 minutes. It's just the way I am.
All right, so you evoke a number of different artists in your essays. You mentioned Mark Twain, F. Scott Fitzgerald, Andrew Wyeth, as you just talked about, Bach, just to name a few. How does the creative work of others influence your writing?
Well, hugely, because, you know, I grew up in this really great working class family, sort of actually a kind of a law enforcement family. And so I was a bit of a alien dropped into this, you know, I was this bookish kid. And so I think that I was always looking for, as I was growing up and reading, a second family. You know, I think everybody feels like they're born into the wrong family to some degree or another, or at least that there's another family out there for them. And so I think over the years, I just subconsciously assembled a kind of cast of people that I connected to, and they feel very real to me. So when I sort of swerve into writing about Bach, it feels like I'm talking about somebody I know.
How does this collection of essays differ from your past writing? You mentioned this is your first published work, but you've written a lot more. So how does it differ from what you've done before? Or does it?
Yeah, it does. So I've done a kind of a lot of different types of writing. Some expository, you know, journalistic writing. And before this, I actually did a creative writing degree in poetry. So I still write poems, but that was what I would consider myself in my 20s. I was a poet and trying to, you know, that's what I imagined I was going to do. But, you know, ultimately, I think I found a form in this kind of maybe a hybrid between a poem and an essay. And I think part of the reason I like this is because it's hard to import information into a lyric poem. It's really difficult because it sort of sucks the air out of the poem. But in an essay, you can bring in almost anything. And I like information. I like historical facts. So that is fuel to me. So I feel like I've kind of found my vein.
All right. One of your essays in the spring section is titled Narcissus. Would you read that one for us?
Yes, I'd be happy to. Narcissus. Just a quick note to say that spring doesn't care about us. It certainly doesn't care about human time. It keeps its own clock, and it comes when it comes. Yes, spring arrived this week after a final undignified coating of snow on Wednesday morning, but not because the spokes of the Gregorian and liturgical calendars seem to serendipitously align. It doesn't care that Sunday is Easter, or that Monday is the first anniversary of the Boston Marathon bombing, or that Tuesday is the 10th anniversary of my near-death experience, crosswalk, minivan. It doesn't care about the theme of resurrection. Spring is an inhuman affair, a paroxysm of nature, a manic procedure that operates beneath our perception like cellular regeneration. and yet we feel it. The shadowy intuition of 100 million hands, tiny and invisible, pushing upwards and outwards, all culminating in the shuddering eruption of a daffodil. I once had a poetry professor with the wild hair and chunky rings of a fortune teller. During a class one April afternoon, while the first wave of pollen was dusting the campus outside, her eyes unfocused, and she wondered aloud, "How many more springs will each of you get?" It was the kind of carpe diem sentiment one is liable to hear in a poetry class. But the motto didn't work its revitalizing magic on me. It never does. Spring is here, but it doesn't care about me, or you, or poetry. We don't seize the day. The day seizes us.
Writing, particularly creative writing and poetry, can be so personal and subjective. What has been your experience with someone editing or critiquing your work?
So, as I mentioned before, I was in an MFA program, which is this strange bubble that you go into for about 2 years, and you have all kinds of critiques of your work coming at you. It's on the one hand, a wonderful resource to have a chorus of voices in your head telling you, we like this part of your writing, we don't like this part of your writing. But it can also be a bit paralyzing and crippling because you can lose your own voice in that. And so this book, for example, I wrote, it was really a solo endeavor. It was sort of an exercise to get myself out of a funk. And nobody edited it. Nobody workshopped it. I was sort of writing without a net. And yet I'm really happy with it. And so I think critiques can be extremely vital for growth. But at some point, you've got to stake out your own ground and kind of find your own entrance into the woods. Mm.
So what do you think makes a good editor?
Oh, gosh.
Because I'm sure you've had good and maybe not so good editors.
Yes. It's funny. I'm thinking of a teacher I once had. You know, I mentioned a poetry teacher in this. This was a different one. But we went for what's called office hours. And that's when you have a kind of one-on-one with the professor. And she had my group of poems that I'd produced that semester, and she put them into two piles. And one pile were sort of impersonal poems, and the other pile were poems that had the pronoun I in them. And she put her hand on the impersonal poems, and she said, "These are very well written." And then she put her hand on the poems with the word I in them, and she said, "These are alive."
Hmm.
And so that was an extremely important moment for me as a writer because it made me realize that you do need to take risks and cut close to the bone.
That's an interesting way of it. It's not like these are better. What a great way to express that.
Yeah, she was an amazing
wow.
teacher. Her name was Sharon Olds, and she's a fantastic poet and an incredible teacher.
So what advice do you have for people who are interested in creative writing, either for pleasure or for publication?
Oh, gosh.
You talked a little bit about finding your voice, and that I think that's probably the hardest thing when you're first getting started.
I would say two things. I would say that a lot of the process of finding your voice is stripping away the writer you wish you were. Okay, because it's so easy, especially when you're in your 20s or wherever you're at, to just line up the books that you love and you want to be those writers. But you can't be those writers. You have to be you. So you've got to let go of that, and you've got to be honest about who you are and take the leap of faith that that's going to be good enough. Mm-hmm. The other thing I would say to people who are interested in creative writing and pursuing that is don't wait to be happy. I spent a lot of time with my sort of like Rocky music playing. Like I have to get my first book published and then I'll be a real writer. And so I think I wasted a lot of years waiting to be happy, waiting for that to happen. And now that it's happened, I'm still the same person I was. There was no reason I couldn't have relaxed a little bit and been more comfortable in where I was in the journey.
What about criticism? When you have editors or you're in a poetry group or writers group and people are critiquing you, and hopefully it's constructive criticism.
Sure.
It's not like that stinks. But right. It can be very, this is something personal and you're like, oh gosh, and your feelings can get hurt. How do you get beyond that?
Yeah. Well, I would say this is interesting thing that I feel like I discovered is that a lot of times it can be helpful. People are good at telling you if there's a problem. If a lot of people are pointing to a particular part of a piece of your writing and saying there's an issue here, that can be really helpful. But they're not always great at coming out with the solution. So I think it's good to listen if people are indicating that there's an issue with a piece of writing, but you don't have to necessarily fix it in the way that they prescribe. Mm-hmm. So that's that kind of being open, but also trusting your gut and staying true to your vision.
So before we let you go, would you read an essay from the October section titled Season of the Soul?
Yes, I would love to. And I think this is a good essay to read right now because it was written for exactly this time of year. The Season of the Soul. I love to take long Sunday morning walks in October when the wind is crisp and the leaves are tumbling down, and every 20 feet or so you have to step over the viscera of a shattered pumpkin. This morning I was almost run over. I was distracted by a dozen crows screaming in an oak tree. It might have been a crow funeral. They do that. Anyways, an ultramarine minivan blew through a stop sign. They do that. And missed my foot by a foot. Afterward, I spent a long time fiddling with my iPod, trying to find a song for the occasion of not being flattened. I thought of Nietzsche, who preferred his music, quote, cheerful and profound, like an October afternoon. Nietzsche had an autumn problem. For 10 years, he wandered Europe like a hypochondriac Goldilocks, looking for a warm but not humid autumnal climate. He finally settled on Turin, whose impeccable grid of paved streets allowed him to take walks despite his failing eyesight. Wonderful clarity, he wrote upon arriving in Turin. Autumn colors, an exquisite sense of well-being emanating from all things. Of course, it was on one of these walks that Nietzsche encountered a broken-down cart horse being whipped. He flung his arms around the animal, sobbed violently, and never regained his sanity. I didn't see anything this morning to make me lose my sanity. Just some roses on their deathbeds, just the sun low in the sky, sliding its meager warmth like a final offer face down across a table. But I do keep thinking of that close call, and how my ancestors, every last forefather and foremother, survived without exception to bear children, and how those children in turn survived to bear children. An unbroken chain of human beings who never ate the wrong berry, who never missed the snake in the grass, who never misjudged the strength of a branch or their own strength in the waves, who were never the friend drowned in the creek but always the friend who ran home dripping to tell about it, who were never the mourned, always the mourning, forever, all the way back, pin balanced on pin, the ultimate winning streak, the inconceivable, astonishing luck of it.
Will Dowd's book of essays is titled Areas of Fog. We'll have a link with more information about his book at our website, capeandislands.org. Well, thanks for coming and sharing your work. Really, we really enjoyed talking to you.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Coming up after a break, we continue our conversation about creative writing with our Poetry Sunday advisors.